A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, welcome to the 280th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Tyler Small and Tyler Eaton. Thanks, Tylers. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today we have Kara Durrett on the podcast. She is a producer, like with a capital P. She's made a bunch of features. She's made a bunch of short films. She's been to all the good festivals, South by, Sundance, Venice, Cannes. She was a Sundance Producer Lab Fellow. She had a couple movies that she shot over the pandemic. She just did a show as well. So she's doing it. And she also happens to be married to this DP, Lowell A. Mayer, who's a big fan of and is also very talented. And we had a really good conversation with her. I love talking to producers.
Yeah, it's a thing that we're trying to make a habit of is, you know, we talk to so many great directors and that's wonderful. But I think a lot of directors listen to the show. And so you can learn stuff from directors, but you could also learn stuff from the people that you collaborate with. And so, yeah, we're making a concerted effort to kind of talk to more producers and other types of people that you one collaborates with.
Yeah, I'd say my theme for the podcast for the past year has been, how do I get my project made? And producers have a lot of insight into that. Obviously, directors do too, that have made projects, but I love hearing from producers and seeing the elements that they look for in a director, in a project, in everything, you know, in terms of financing and cast and script and creative and resume and what it takes to make a movie, like $1 million movie or a $10 million movie or a show. So we had a really good time talking to Kara, and I think you're going to enjoy this episode.
But before we hop into our conversation with her, I'm going to go ahead and mention a few of the movies that she's done, just to get a little more specific in case people are curious. And also, we talk about them a lot. So our friends Alex and Eleanor Wilson's Save Yourselves, we had them on the show earlier this year. She's got an upcoming project with Celine Held and Logan George that we talk a decent amount about, produced by M. Night Shyamalan, called Vanishings, coming out soon, or that they're shooting soon. And then David Craig and Brian Cranos' I Don't Understand You, alongside producer Joel Edgerton. So a lot of cool stuff. South by, Sundance, you know, the whole gamut. But we dig in deep with her. We get to talk about just the nature of being a producer and what it takes and her some of her lessons along the way. And also just kind of about the current climate of being an independent producer and how one supports oneself and thrives making indie films, along with, you know, some other side hustles as well.
Yeah. Before we talk to Kara, I wanted to, who, by the way, has the same name as my wife, which is pretty confusing because I keep saying Kara and my wife keeps coming into the room and saying, like, what do you want? But before we talk to Kara, I was going to talk to you just for a second about notes. I'm in the middle of this project. We're in post on a bunch of different edits. And because of COVID, again, I have like two big gripes about COVID aside from the disease part of it all.
The death.
And yeah. One is that I don't get to put my own half and half in my coffee at the coffee shop anymore. So they're always putting in the wrong amount. If I tell them to put a little extra in,
you know,
then it's like way too much.
That, Orin. You know the trick.
Ask for it on the side and put it in myself?
No, drink it black like a real person.
Oh, come on. That's not a trick. That's
show
that's
yourself
giving up.
Self-respect. No, it's the other way around.
Okay. And the other thing is that you don't get to sit in the edit bay with the editor. They put their edit on Frame.io or whatever software, Dropbox. They send you a video and you're like, okay, at this time code, this doesn't look good. Or is there a different take for this? Or this cuts a little fast.
Well, so
and
the
you
obvious
don't get
question,
to try things.
The obvious question is, have you sessioned with them remotely? right? Because I, you know, I've done pretty long sessions with editors where they'll go ahead and
like share their screen,
and yeah, it's pretty great. It's pretty seamless. It's, you know, you can't point, you can't, you know, elbow them out of the chair and sit down and just do
right.
it yourself.
Can I drive?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
no.
my favorite line to say in an edit bay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're very popular with editors. Will.
Yeah, but is it real time? Like, can you tell the timing mm-hmm. and the pacing?
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty
I guess
great.
I could have sessioned a little bit. I don't know. Yeah, now you're just making me regret all of my life decisions. But what I was going to say was this very specific note that I give a lot, which is, hey, can you bring the midtones down on this shot a little bit so it matches the previous shot and the next shot? And I imagine a lot of editors, because I'm working now on this big project, there's three different editors. And they all, none of them are, you know, they put the LUT or whatever on the, that we filmed with on the footage, but some one shot we shot on Wednesday, and one shot we shot on Friday, and one shot we shot on daytime, one shot. And to me, when I'm showing clients or agency people like edits or anyone, you know, it doesn't have to be a commercial. It could be a short film. It could be a feature film screening that you're showing your friends. And the color is all over the place. Like one shot's bright, one shot's dark, one shot's, you know, the white balance is off. It throws me off and I'm no longer giving notes on, like I'm no longer processing whether the cut is working. I'm just noticing these shifts in light. And I'm wondering, do you ever give those types of notes of like, can you just darken this a little bit, or can you make the color match the next shot a little better in a temp edit, obviously before not a formal color grade?
Yeah, I would say that I do not do that unless it's really egregious, unless it's like really like, you know, there's a problem or like, you know, a mistake or just the circumstances were so radically different that, you know, right. Anyone would be able to tell.
Well, what if like I see an edit where like this shot has a LUT, this has shot has a LUT, this next shot is in log, and then the next shot has a LUT on it, you know?
Well, then you ask for the, yeah, you definitely.
You say, like, hey.
Yeah, you would be like, hey, I need to see this with a LUT. I think what we're really getting at, there's two things here, right? One, we're talking about the relationship that you have with the editor, right? And doing a good job early on of setting the table of explaining the way that you like to work and why you're asking for these things, and that even though you know that it's not really quote unquote their job, it helps sell the edit, you know, all of the reasons that you just explained to me why it's important to you. Making that clear to an editor means that you're not just acting like a diva, like there's some thought behind this and you're working together to make the best possible edit delivered to clients so that they have less work to do later, maybe. So there's that. And then there's also, I think the more interesting and important part is like, there's a newer set of expectations on editors today than there was even 2 years ago. And certainly than there was from back in the day when everyone was cutting on flatbeds. And that's that editors and assistant editors are expected sometimes, or rather, I think maybe people like you and I really like it when they have a level of VFX expertise and finishing expertise that would not normally be part of the job description.
They're putting some titles on, logos, animation.
Titles, logos, but I'm talking about like...
They're temping all the VFX in too.
Temping
the
screens. Not just screens, but like split screens is a thing. Or like, you know, doing that kind of subtle speed ramping and stuff and like finessing the footage in a way that's not just setting ins and outs and fades. You know what I mean? But like really kind of digging in. And my favorite editors are solid VFX artists as well, you know?
Yeah. And even what we talked to Kara about in this episode is that a lot of their most amazing naturalistic performances are created by editors who are, you know, adding freeze frames to eyes so that they're not darting around or not moving. We have the tools, like why not use them? And yeah, it is unfair. And our editors, this project I'm working on, the turnaround is like insane. What we finished shooting Friday night at 10 p.m. they needed to show the agency by Sunday morning, you know? So it's like they have no time, and I'm sure they're so annoyed that Oren's like giving them notes on the LUT. But to me, when you're showing an agency and a client thing, you want them to give you notes that matter. And you don't like we had this temp text in there, and I told them, look, this obviously I know this is temp text, but if you don't want to get notes on this, then make it say the right thing, because the worst thing to me is like a client saying, oh, let's remove this shot of this insert shot. It doesn't look great. And you're like, yeah, it doesn't look great because the LUT's not on there. And you're now like trying to explain technical things instead of worrying about story and pacing and flow and music.
And also it's a distraction. Maybe then all of a sudden you're kind of like fighting for this shot, whereas maybe it should be cut. Yeah. But for a different reason than maybe they think.
Totally.
I think that's a thing that you're always going to have to battle with. And I think that's why once you find a collaborator that you really understand each other on those terms, you don't let those people go. And I think there's a certain type of editor, I'm thinking of Julian Doan, who was one of the editors on Townies, is the exact sort of person I'm talking about, where like, I would be like, can we retime this shot a little bit? And he's like, yeah, I'm already doing it. Let's finesse it just a tiny bit more.
Yeah, and didn't he have a short at Sundance last year?
Exactly, he just announced a new feature that he's doing. Like, those guys just rise to the top so fast.
And I think, I cannot say this enough, I've said it a million times on the podcast, but show people the best possible cut you can. When you're showing people rough cuts, spend a day on the sound mix and on the color grade so that it's good, even though you're going to have to redo the whole thing. Because, it's just putting your best foot forward, even if it's just a friends and family screening, is just so important. And it is the best people. And again, like Kara, who we talked to on this interview, talks about the directors she works with and how planned they are and how meticulous they are and how crazy detail oriented they are, because those are the filmmakers that succeed, are the ones that really care about every frame.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And look, I get it. It feels like, well, why do I need to do this thing? The colorist is going to do it again later. Like, this work, the work we're describing in a sound mix or in via a VFX pass or in a color pass, most of the time, those will be redone by specialists. That's true. But it also is part of the gig now,
And it's the story.
Yeah, definitely. Sometimes you did remind me about with text, for instance, if something is truly temp and there's nothing else you can do about it, I explicitly tell them to make it as ugly and bad as possible so that there's no possible way that anyone will ever think it's anything but temp. Like, put red temp text on top of it, just make it so obvious and overt and explicit that there's no way you could misunderstand it for anything besides a placeholder.
Yeah. I tell them, can you just send me the footage real quick and I'm going to put it in After Effects and make it look passable. Then I'll send them a comp back.
Which is okay. I think there's, again, if you do the groundwork of like, there's a world where you can say, you're not like, step aside, I know how to do this better. It's like, no, I know that you've got a lot of things on your plate. This is something that's really important to me. And so like, it's still an inconvenience to you to send me the shot. But if you're willing to go that far for me, I'm willing to sub it in and get it the way I need it to while you're working on the other 1,000 things that you have to worry about.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, editing is underappreciated. And when I'm in the editor's chair, when someone's like, hey, we need this thing by tomorrow, I'm like, you're asking me for so much. I only have so much time.
Yeah.
I'm like a very anxious editor. But anyway.
Yeah,
well,
just
cool.
Screaming as you're, what's that hotkey? Ah! Where's my shortcut?
I find editing stressful because I want to see every combination of every edit ever before I make a decision.
I feel like I lose objectivity at a certain point. You just start seeing, you're like, okay, well, that's the one version and I see how it's different, but I can't tell what's better anymore. That's why I like working with editors.
Yeah, it's like, well, I'm gonna try to get all three of these angles for this one motion in because we shot them. Got to get them in there. Okay, speaking of moving on and not trying every combination of a conversation, we're gonna talk to Kara. But first, we're gonna tell you about our Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, you can throw us $1, $2, $4. Clinton Cornwell sent us 13, and then he changed it to 5. But guess what? I'm gonna send him a hat anyway. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it was a mistake. Clinton, let us know. It probably wasn't.
I think he wanted a hat. He wanted a hat. Maybe cover some postage or whatever.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate it, Clinton. And your hat is on its way. But yeah, it's just a way we can pay our editors, pay our people, pay our all our various service fees, web server fees.
I keep finding things to have this show spend money on so that you and I don't get to pocket any of it.
Yeah, I know. I'm always like, $19 on what? Analytics? It's crazy. Anyway, patreon.com/justshootapod. We really appreciate it.
Before we talk to Kara, perhaps we'll hear something from a sponsor or two.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Let's back things up a little bit, because I feel like we could talk for hours about just the nature of producing. But let's start at the beginning. I think that maybe gives us a little bit of structure. I think earlier, maybe even off the mic, you said you didn't go to film school. How did you first get started producing? What were those first kind of few incremental jobs for you?
So I did not go to school for producing. I went for theater. My mom was a producer forever. And I was always told, like, whatever you do, just don't be a producer.
Like a Hollywood movie producer?
Yeah, she did. Like, she lived in Texas. She was like a local, you know, TV producer. She worked at like a TV station, and she did like local movies that came through. And she was very involved in like the film scene in Texas growing up. And I liked it, but I was like I was much more drawn into theater, to be honest. So I thought I was going to be doing like Shakespeare at the Globe or something. It was like my dream.
That's funny, because then, I feel like anytime I do a travel job, I'm always jealous of the locals, because it seems like they have nice, regular lives. They're just like the person you call them if you're going to shoot in Dallas. There's three producers and two of them are working, so the third one gets called, you know?
Oh, yeah. And they also like, they won't, you know, they won't kill themselves, because they're kind of like, what are you going to do? Call someone else?
Yeah,
like, there aren't many.
Like,
so it's like,
right.
You kind of have
luck,
to,
huh?
They just do it on their own time.
And they all have like side hustles too. Like, yeah, I own part of this bar too. Party there.
Oh, they're also always like, I'm a location manager, and I'm like an AC. And I'm like, how do you do all of that?
And then you realize that's not that hard, actually.
I know, exactly.
Anyway, you were saying.
Yeah, we make it too precious. Anyway, so yeah, my mom is a producer, and I did theater for a while. I lived in New York. I did comedy for a long time. I did like sketch comedy and did UCB and all that kind of stuff for a few years. And then like
mostly performing and writing also?
Like performing and writing and doing all that kind of stuff. And I liked it. Like, I love living in New York. And then, I don't know, like, I saw all my friends start hitting like Broadway, and then they'd come back to like cater waitering, or I was like a wedding planner for a while as like a side hustle, because it was like my brain was very good at that kind of stuff. And so I kind of did all those little jobs, and then I moved to LA and I became a celebrity's assistant.
You're not allowed to say which celebrity.
I became I can say. I mean, I signed an NDA, but I can tell you who it is. I became William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman.
Ooh, that's
assistant.
A good one. That's great.
Yeah, I worked for them for a long time. And like, honestly, they kind of introduced me into film. Like Bill was just starting to direct and he was like, you should come and like be an associate producer. And I like didn't know what it meant. I was like, okay. And so like I went on a first set and I did a few movies with him where I kind of like worked up in the ranks and I just became really good friends with the producers on those movies. And to be honest, like the first time I was on set, I was like, oh, I'm like totally meant to be a producer. Like, I don't really know what I've been doing for this many years. So I kind of quickly transitioned.
A wedding planner isn't like that far off, right?
Oh, it's like the exact same thing.
A wedding planning and assistant work together, that's most of producing, basically. Yeah.
It's literally 100% of producing. Like, it's, you know, wedding planning is like every day of work is someone's most important day. So you're just, everyone's always at like 100. Like, you're very adept with, like, or whatever the word is, of like, taking care of people at their
have
most
have you
stressed.
Helped like friends with their weddings at all now that you're
I have
because
I've done a,
but do you feel like I feel like whenever I have like to step in to like help on something like that I am always like everybody get out of the way because like you don't know what you're talking about like we can do this in my sleep like can we just get this done you know
it's kind of funny how much I just turned it off like now I go to weddings and I'm just like the happiest guest I'm just like bring food and drinks and like I don't do anything I'm like so I enjoy everything but yeah I was a wedding planner weirdly and then yeah I don't know I just once I got on set I was like very 100% I like kind of quit everything else and just stopped focusing on other stuff and was like, oh, I think I just, if I put all my energy into this, I think I could be good and like be okay at this.
But this first set that you were on, you know, through these people that you were working with, like was a big Hollywood studio set probably, right?
Yeah, it was a big movie. And it was cool. It was like the direct, you know, the producer was this woman named Rachel Winter who did Dallas Buyers Club. And like, it was a very, like Rosario Dawson and Kathy Bates was in it. And like all of these really cool actors and I definitely quickly learned like the role of the producer. Like I probably shouldn't say that. I remember asking Bill Macy being like, what's producer do? And he was like, you just agree with me all the time. It's like, okay. So I just like did that. He'd be like, I want more money. And I was like, I agree. So I just like did that for a while.
It's interesting to kind of come in at that level, like at the highest level and then kind of go back to like, you know,
well, and yeah, go back and do like music videos for free. I mean, in a weird way, it was almost really nice because I learned very quickly, like I have no interest in studios and I have no interest in like celebrity-ness. Like I have no, I'm not like starstruck by people.
What
like,
helped you realize that? What was the thing that helped you clue in to that feeling?
I think working for people who are in that level of their lives, it was like, you know, as much as celebrities have like a bad rap, it's also like a really hard life. Like every relationship is like
commoditized.
It's tricky because you're like, yeah, it's like, do they want something from me? It's like every conversation, everything with
and
everyone
the answer's kind of yes.
Kind of turns into something
kind
else.
Of yes.
Yeah, it totally
unless
is.
There's someone and so, as like, famous and in a totally different realm, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you kind of see that they're living in this, you know, little place of just like protecting themselves because they have to. And so you kind of learn quickly, like, I don't necessarily feel like I want to be a part of this machine that's like feeding, you know, not egos, but like feeding these people in this way. Like the very big movies where people just do whatever the celebrities want. It's like, I just found it to be kind of funny. And I just quickly found myself not being drawn towards it at all.
It's kind of a story we hear as a way into work that is pretty common, but we never really talk about it on the podcast, which is like assisting a celebrity. You know, like, I don't know if you went through the UTA job list or there's certain ways that when you move to LA, you can kind of be someone's assistant and you instantly get exposure. Like we had, you know, JJ Abrams assistant. We had a lot of people who started that way. And it's kind of like not a bad way to learn about everything. Fast,
it's the,
you know?
It's honestly the best way because like I didn't go to film school and I also never worked at a desk and I never worked at a production company and I never PA'd, like I never did any of this stuff that people do. So I didn't have like the language, like I didn't understand. I knew like art, I knew how like to talk about scripts, I knew how to break down characters, like I came from that world, but I did not understand like how to call an agent or like how that dynamic works. So doing it for other people for a long time, you kind of just quickly pick up the language, and it's very helpful. Like, I applied to go to USC grad school, and I remember I got in, and I remember I was like, you know what, I'm going to assist for a year, and I'm going to see how I feel in a year. And if I still want to go to grad school for film, because I thought I was so behind, I was like, if I still want to go to like grad school, then I'll go. But for now, I'll just do this. And then I did it. And it's true. Like, I learned so much, like, instantly, just about like development, about like attaching to projects, how actors read projects, how agents pitch projects, like kind of everything. I highly recommend it. I tell everyone who's like, what should I do when I come to LA? And I'm always like, just get a job at a desk or with someone that you can just be on the phone all the time and like listen to it. Cause it is like a game in a weird way.
Yeah. I wonder if from working with them, how much you learned about attaching talent to your projects.
I definitely look at projects now, like from their point of view. I mean, they're both very talented actors and they both have such long careers. They're not like hot and, you know, they're like new. They've just had such longevity. So there is a bit of me that I understood like what they were looking for in times. And like, I would read projects for them. So it was interesting to have conversations with them about like what they were looking for. So I definitely have an approach with actors that I take that is probably different than some people because of that experience. But
yeah, I mean, I think that there's also, it sounds basically like you were, you know, the third member of their production company, you know?
And so totally.
I think that that is, it's kind of a crapshoot with the assistant gig, right? Sometimes you are in a situation where you can be around people who really like guide you and help you. And sometimes you're just like picking up dry cleaning and
and sometimes you're doing both. Yeah. Like, I definitely did a lot on both sides, but like they had another assistant, they had a nanny, like that we had, there was a team of people. So I was very, like, I went to set with them. Like, I was very integrated. I was on the Shameless set with them. Like, I was kind of integrated in their lives in that way. So in a way it was very nice. And they also, I will say, like, I met them through the Atlantic Theater Company, which is where I studied school. And then when I came to LA, it was like kind of a connection through a teacher there. And they were very invested. They were very like, we know you want to do this. Like, Bill, I remember when he was doing the movie, he was like, you want to be a producer? You should come to Atlanta with me and like be on the set and like learn how it works. Like, they really did give me an opportunity that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So like, I am very grateful in that way that they kind of just like allowed me to see in for a while, because it was very helpful. I mean, I wouldn't be anywhere without that like access, to be honest.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. So I'm curious, just in thinking about, you have that background, you have that experience with them, and then, you know, then you kind of, it sounds like you probably started to side hustle and doing your own projects, do those the kind of early producing gigs that everybody cuts their teeth on, unpaid music videos and the like, right? Were there things where you were like, were there surprises when you all of a sudden were kind of doing these smaller budget things where you were like, well, I knew it was going to be hard, but I didn't realize we wouldn't have this sort of
No, I think I was kind of the opposite, because I came from theater. Like, I remember when I started doing shorts and music videos, which is like how I kind of got started, like mainly shorts, I would go to festivals. So like when I was working for Bell and Felicity, I would go to festivals and I would get a pass and I would just go see only the short blocks, and I would just meet all the directors of the shorts that I loved afterwards, and I would basically just be like, if you have another short, I'll work for free. And I did that for like 9 or 10 shorts. Like, I did like a couple years where I just only did shorts for people that I was very big fans of. And then those shorts kind of grew into features. And then I kind of started working with people through those, you know, relationships that they then knew people that were really talented. So I was very like, I kind of cherry picked the best out of these places because I was able to do that. But like,
and I mean, this is like the Sun, like you would go to Sundance.
I'd go to Sundance. I'd go to South By. I'd go to like all of, yeah, I'd basically do those. I mean, South By has incredible short films. Like, they have some of the best shorts, I think, of any festival. No offense to any other, but like Claudette and those guys who like pick them are incredible. And so I remember just like picking people. Like, I met Selena Logan, the movie we were talking about earlier, and I'm sure we'll talk about, like, I met them at South By. I met Laurel Parmed, who I'm doing her movie. I met so many people from those places, just from like literally after a premiere, I'd walk up to them and be like, I'm a fan. Like, what are you working on? And for me, it was almost the opposite, because I came from theater. People would be like, I only have $10,000. And I was like, $10,000 is incredible. Like, where'd you get $10,000? So for me, it was like so much money, because in theater, you have $0. And so I was like, I don't have to put any money in. Like, this is amazing. Like, we should do something. I'll work for free. Like, it's fine. And even the first few movies, like Save Yourselves, like, I remember all of us, you know, a lot of people were like, I can't believe you're gonna make a movie for that small. And I was like, yeah, but it's like way more than you would at a show, like a theater show. So we're gonna be fine. Like, we'll get lunch every day. This is incredible.
Wait, I'm curious, when you pitch yourself as a producer, I think a lot of people, especially in the feature world, that, you know, it's probably different in shorts, think of a producer as someone that helps them get money. You know, was that part of your pitch, or were you, did you just...
In the beginning, it wasn't, because I didn't know how to get it. And now I do. So now I definitely never promise money, but I definitely pitch like I know how to build the machine, because I do. And I actually really enjoy it. Like, a lot of producers hate the money part, and I actually find it kind of fun. Like, it's a fun game for me to be like, will I get 2 or 3 million? It's like a fun, weird, twisted thing for me to try to get the most bang out of someone to like creatively make something. So I, as I've evolved and as I've learned how to do it, now I can kind of bring that to the table. But in the beginning, I was very honest. I was like, I don't know, how do people get money? Like, I'll just be there to, like, you know, make sure it all goes smoothly and like pay everyone. But like, I didn't know that stuff. I don't even know who knows that in the beginning. Like, it's such a weird skill.
So were you offering, I guess I hear a lot of people that want to be like creative producers, and then they just want to hire like a UPM and a coordinator and it, you know, but
you're,
when you're doing a short,
shaking your head in disdain.
I know. Yeah. I'm shaking my head because I don't believe in that term. I find it to be very crazy.
Crazy. Tell us why.
Crazy is the wrong word. I find it to be very,
like pretentious or presumptuous,
yeah.
Maybe
it's very like strange. It's like whenever people are like I have a lot of people reach out and will be like, I want to be more of a creative producer. And I'm like, oh, that's fun. Like, that's not a thing, but like, good luck with that. Like, you enjoy that. Like, if you want to be a creative producer, that means you're friends with the director and you want to show up on set and right. Like hang out.
Or maybe you want to be a development exec.
Yeah. Or you want to be a development exec, but like a creative producer is not a term that I understand or like get. Like, it doesn't make sense to me. Cause in my mind, I was told early on by a friend of mine, when I was leaving Bill and Felicity, and I was like, I want to start producing on my own. I want to do whatever I can to make money. I have to find a job. A friend of mine who is a very big producer now, at the time, had just made a few features. And he was like, I'm going to give you a secret. He was like, learn to be a line producer and don't tell anyone you know how to do it. And you should do it on commercials and you should do it on shorts, do it on everything you can so that you know how it works, because you don't want to be the person who shows up to set and doesn't know how to do anything. And I did that. Like, I just went to commercial houses. I just like started doing music videos. I started doing it and I would get paid, and I just line produce slash produce because it's the same, it's basically the same job. And now that I'm in the feature world more, like, I see these producers who are just like, I don't know about a budget. I need to like get a line producer. And I'm like, that must be so nice that you have the money to pay for someone to make you a budget. Like, I have to do all
right.
of that.
Well,
myself.
And even
like,
when, you know, your movies get big enough that it doesn't make sense for you to do that, when it comes time to, like, you know, solve some problems, you can crack that budget open and know what you're looking at.
Yeah, you know how to do it. Like, you know how to work it, and you can have a conversation. I mean, I think a line producer is very, very important because it's someone who's only watching specific parts that, and your brain is split, right? Like, you are the person who's with the director and with the actors and with the agents and with the financier and with everyone. But like, the line producer's job is just to make sure people are getting paid, to make sure budgets are on time, make sure that we're on schedule. And all of those things are very important to the film succeeding. So you have to have someone who is focused on that. But like, that doesn't mean I'm not involved in that. Like, I'm on every cost report. I'm on any change with that budget. Like, I'm very, very involved in those conversations because I find the people who are like, it's not my thing. I'm just like, well, then I don't know what your thing is. Like, that is part of the job. That's
a creative
the whole
producer,
job.
Yeah, it's like someone that doesn't want to do any of the hard part.
Exactly. You just want to be like, I don't do paperwork. And you're like, well, then, I don't know, be a manager.
Or a director.
Do something else. Or a director.
Yeah, or it's like being a director that doesn't want to, you know, select people for casting you know,
yeah,
like there's a lot of fun things in directing. He doesn't want to pitch or write treatments. Like, there's a lot of parts of directing that aren't fun that you kind of have to do to get the fun part.
Well, and I don't think that one feeds the other. Like, I don't think I'd be as good at the creative if I didn't know how much money we have, or like, I don't think I'd be as good at conversations with the director about like how to achieve something in post if I didn't understand like how far off we were during production. So like, the idea that you're just kind of throwing ideas out there and you have no concept of where you're at is like, that's not helpful. It's like a hobby at that point. Like, you're not really doing the job. You're kind of just like giving some ideas as a friend and then like going home. It's like a weird, I don't know. I can go on about this for a long time. You probably don't want me to talk about this for a long time.
Well, I am curious, when you kind of started producing these shorts, music videos, commercials, all these things, what the ratio of things you were producing because you really were excited about the material versus things that you were just producing to learn how to produce, and you didn't really care as much about
or,
that.
Or did you? Did you care about all of them, maybe?
I think I cared about all of them. I think I just decided early on, like, I couldn't do it if I didn't love it. Like, commercials, I definitely do and I don't love, but they're so fast. And I would kind of do them as an experiment of, like, I need to learn something and this will be helpful to me. Like, I need to learn how DGA works, or I need to learn how, you know, IA works in LA. I need to work, like, I need to understand these things because it will help me. But I would just do, I do very small commercials.
You're talking about the union, various unions.
Yeah, the unions. Like, I do very short commercials. I don't do, like, I did like a 6-week travel job one time for T-Mobile, and it was like a documentary basically. And that taught me like how documentaries work. And I remember at the time it was like actually a really beautiful project because it was about like female entrepreneurs. And I was like, this is technically commercial and it's paying me commercial rates, but like what a cool commercial to do.
Can I ask how you, you know, because I think the indie feature world and the indie short world doesn't, aside from crew, doesn't really overlap that much with the commercial world. How do you go to like a big commercial production company and say, hey, let me produce your 6-week T-Mobile shoot?
I think it happened organically. Like people started, it's really easy to be a producer if you work hard. Like people always think like they don't know how to become a producer. And I'm like, just work endless hours and like don't ever ask for more money and like have a good attitude and people will just keep hiring
you.
Like,
hold on. I'm going to pump the brakes there because that is true for sure. I love that. But I think that there are probably some specific tactics that you employed that maybe you haven't even thought about in, you know, however many years. But
but think about the tactics. Right. But people always say this. People are always like, I don't know how to do budgets. And it's like, well learn. If you just learn, you'll be fine.
Yeah, totally. I meant more like, okay, you went to South by Southwest and introduced yourself to the filmmakers that you liked, right? Like that's such a perfect nugget that it feels like maybe a person like you just like intuitively, you're like, yeah, I'll just go find the best filmmakers and I'll introduce myself. But like sometimes it's nice to be prescriptive and be like, these are the ways in which I was smart about introducing myself to the right people, or like how to show that I'm a hard worker or offer up my skills. You know what I mean? Were there any other things like that? How did you first meet those, you know, people at different production companies that were hiring you later on? Like, is it just social?
I met them at South By or Sundance. And I also met them through friends. Like I started meeting them. I would do like a music video and then like that director would be like, oh, I have a commercial. Like, do you want to do it? It's really small. It's like a PSA. And then I would do that one. And then like someone from that production company would then be like, oh, I have this other little thing that like no one wants to do. Can you do it? So I kind of did that for a while, to be honest. I just like bounced around. I mean, I've been very lucky. Like I did not have to do commercials long and I only have to do a few at a time. And I always had heard the phrase like golden handcuffs. Of just like, don't get sucked in because your life will be taken over. So I've really tried to be like, how much money do I actually need? Like, I don't need to do another one. Like I can survive another month and I don't need to do another one. And then in a month I'll figure it out. But like, I should spend this month developing this feature. Otherwise I'm just going to keep doing them over and over and then I'll be trapped.
So, are you talking about us? Or in a night.
Talking about you, this podcast. Yeah, it's like, no, like I actually think like that was my theory, was just like only take what you need and then move on very quickly. I also was told this, never tell commercial people you do features and never tell feature people you do commercials. And I still don't do that. Like I still have commercial companies that reach out to me and they have no idea I do features and then like vice versa. And I just never talk about them to each other. I'm just always like, I'm booked on a job and I just leave it at that. Because I don't want them to know. Because they're not the same world, and it's a different skill. So
yeah, I love that.
I will say when I do commercials, and we have the pre-production meeting, I do say like, by the way, our producer just had a film at Sundance. Our costume designer does, yeah. You know, the Conners on ABC.
Or it's all like, about hyping people like that. I love it. Yeah.
I want the clients and the agency to be excited, and also to know that we're bringing people with taste, you know, to the project. And so when we're on set and they're like, this, I hate that shirt. And you're like, well, this is a costume designer from iCarly or whatever, you know, like you want them to trust you. But what was the first feature you produced?
My first, well, technically it was the movie Crystal with Bill Macy. And then he did another movie called The Layover that I worked on. And these were like junior producer roles. And then basically my very first producing credit was Topside. It was probably Selena Logan's feature. And then I did Save Yourselves. And then I've done Honk. And then I've done a few more since then. But like, yeah, probably Topside was my first. And I'd done 5 shorts with those guys and I met them at South By. So
anyone listening to this, if you're not driving a car or running on a treadmill or whatever people do, I imagine a lot of our listenership doesn't run on treadmills that much. But you should check out Celine Held and Logan George just on Vimeo or wherever, because I've watched a bunch of their shorts and they're all quite incredible. And I'm curious. So you linked up with them at South By, you said?
Mm-hmm. And they had they had a short called Mouse that was in the midnight section. And Lowell, my husband, had shot it. But at the time, we were not married or we had like just met. So we all kind of got connected like socially. And I was just such a fan of theirs. And they went to theater school too. And we kind of just like quickly connected on like New York theater. And then they told me, they were like, oh, we actually have this short idea in Texas. Like, would you want to go down and do it? And I was like, because I'm from Texas. And I was like, yeah, like my parents will cater, like we'll stay in my cousin's camper. Like I did the whole thing, the whole pitch, and they brought me on and I was really lucky. And then that short went on and did Cannes and was shortlisted for the Oscars and had a whole life. So
I'm curious what you saw about their work that made you a fan of theirs, that attracted you to their
I think that stuff. their work, when I saw Mouse, I just remember thinking it was incredibly like emotional, like not in like a sad way, but it was very visceral. It's like shorts, I think a lot. Now I've seen thousands of shorts at this point, but like so many shorts take themselves so seriously and they take themselves right. So like everything.
The melodrama.
The melodrama right. And the moment, and they have to get that one moment. And like Selena Logan, like if you've ever seen Mouse, which is one of their first shorts, it's like about this like kind of drug addict couple in New York, and they find a mouse in a can of beans and they want to sue the company so they can get millions of dollars. And it's just them like tweaking out over the night being like, oh my God, like how do we do it? And then like they eat the mouse and like it becomes this whole kind of evolution of their lives. And I just found it to be like hilarious and fascinating and terrifying. And like the people in the audience were reacting so insanely. And so it was like kind of fun to see people like go
on a
ride.
It's what you're hoping for in a South By Midnight program, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It was like the best midnight short you could see, because it just gives you, like wakes you up at midnight when you're watching it.
And then when you first teamed up with them, were they making a living from shorts? Or
like, no, no way. They were doing school videos. They were traveling the world. They were a 2-person team and they had their own camera and they would travel to like Indonesia and do like private school videos for people to sign up for private school. So they made money that way, and they didn't make a lot of money. And they would Airbnb their apartment out in New York City, this studio, and they would put a tent on their roof and sleep on the roof while the Airbnb people, 100%. They would bike around the city all night, and then they would use the money from Airbnb to pay for all their shorts.
That is so hardcore.
The first year. Oh, it was crazy. Like the first year I met them, they had saved enough money and they were like working restaurant jobs, like everything you can imagine. They'd saved enough money and they were like, we're going to make 3 shorts back to back and try to use like the same insurance and the same people and like just try to do it as fast as possible. And then we'll like release them later on. And so they did Caroline, and then like, I don't know how long, maybe a month later, we did Lockdown, and they did a short called Babs, which I did not do. It was in London and they used the whole London producing team. But they did those within like 2 months of each other. Like it was insane. It was amazing.
Is Caroline the one with the kid in the car?
Yeah.
Oh, I know that short. So good. That short is
great. That's the one in Texas.
Yeah, that's incredible. That short is incredible. Yeah, I love it.
And was your hope with them to like follow their career to a feature?
Like, yeah, that's a good
like,
question.
Oh yeah, I was gonna like ride their coattails all the way to the end, which I still have. Like I'm leaving in a few weeks to go do their next movie. They were just on such a mission. I mean, in a weird way, we really connected about it, because I think we all were kind of, we had all done the theater thing in New York around the same time, and we'd all spent the time doing that. And I think we all had very intense ambition at the exact same time. And so there was a level of like understanding each other and being like, yeah, we just have to like do it. Like, I mean, a Lockdown was a prime example. I remember I like didn't want to do Lockdown because I was exhausted. Like I had just done Caroline. I was like kind of overwhelmed. And they just convinced, like, they just called me and they were just like, we're doing it. You have to like get to Philadelphia. It's happening. It's going to be great. You'll enjoy it. And then like, I'm so happy I did. I got into Sundance. It like, I think it got us our movie for the feature. Like they were so ambitious. You have to just kind of like jump on. So it's very, very magnetic.
Yeah. So once Lockdown premieres at Sundance and you're the producer and you're there with the directing team and you're this guy you like shot it too.
Yeah, this guy I'm dating.
How do you take that and turn it into a feature? Like what's, can you tell us a little
the
bit
process?
About? Yeah.
Well, they had written a feature years before when we were doing Caroline. They had like sent me the script and we had talked about it. And all of us did not know what we were doing. We were all like, we'll make it for $500,000. Like, it'll be great. We had no idea how much movies cost.
Can you tell us the log line?
It's a five-year-old lives in the New York City tunnels and her mother are evicted by Amtrak moving in and they have to find shelter in the middle of the night of like a New York City cold night. It's a terrible log line.
It takes place like over one night?
Over one night, yeah. In New York City in like the middle of winter.
Does sound kind of expensive.
It does sound expensive.
And we also shot on like subway trains that are moving and like it was a lot. We did not understand. We were like, we'll just put a kid on a train. It'll be fine. And then like, as we started learning more and more, we like, I mean, it's funny, like when you really think about how to start financing and stuff, like I did IFP, which is now called Gotham Project. And that was probably my first intro into like financier world. And we met with every company, like this script was very known and Caroline had such a big splash and Lockdown did, like everyone was like, we want to help you. And then whenever we'd kind of get in the nitty gritty, they were like, that sounds hard. We don't want to help you anymore, but like, we'll watch it. It's like a lot of people.
In the loop.
Yeah. They were like, tell us when you make it. So we had that by like 1,000 companies. And then honestly, like Celine and Logan put their own money into the beginning and started filming. They found a girl and they started filming on their own. And then like very last minute, three financiers like all threw money in.
And were you were producing too at that point?
I produced the financiers. Yeah. I was on it for like a year and a half before the financiers. We got money from a company that was way too good to be true that came to us and was like, we're going to give you all the money. And I was like, this is so easy. Why does everyone have a hard time? And then like, I didn't know what red flags were red flags. And then like quickly within 3 months, I was like, they don't have any money. They've been lying to us. And then like it very quickly dissolved. And I was like, I now know better. Like I now know what contracts to look for and like how to do it better.
I'm curious about, you know, I feel like sometimes we hear the story of like, oh, at the very last minute, financiers came in and saved the day, right? Like you just mentioned. How does that happen? How does that work? Do you know what I mean? Like it sounds like a magic trick.
It doesn't. I mean, it happens from agencies. Like, you know, we had a big champion at Endeavor, like Sam Racanelli, who was just a huge, like they also, Endeavor had a lot to prove because they had just signed Celine Logan, WME did, and Anonymous had just signed Celine Logan from the shorts. So I think there was a bit of hype of like, we're going to pull through. So I remember when we were leaving the company that didn't have the money and we realized it quickly, we called WME and we were like, we're all idiots. Like, we don't know what to do. How do we get out of this? And they were like, okay, let us walk you back. And they like walked us out of that deal. And then they basically sent out a wide thing that was like, hey, they have a cast. They have a location. They're ready to go. All they need is like X amount of dollars. And a bunch of companies kind of toyed us around for a while. And then it just started happening. Like we ended up bringing on a fancy producer, like a bigger producer named Anthony Bregman, who kind of gave the project like a bit of a weight because I was the only producer and I was still so new. So that we kind of brought someone in to give financiers that reassurance. So he came in as like a name only kind of. And then basically all the financiers were like, well, now the team is so great. We can't say no.
That's interesting. I feel like a lot of times you hear, you know, new filmmakers are trying to make a feature and they're like, oh, well, let's just get a producer that people know. And then they don't even have to do anything, but just having them attached.
There's a lot of
money.
But it sounds like it worked for you.
Kind of. I mean, I wouldn't say like the financiers became because of him, but I think that there was a hesitancy with them. And I think that likely story and that team definitely gave them like, they know what they're doing. It's going to be okay. I think they gave us that like security.
Safe hands, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess I was just going to mention, it's not just that producer. Like they also are up by Anonymous and rep by William Morris and had Sundance Films and were at Soundbox.
And were ready to go, right? Like it couldn't be closer.
Yeah, exactly. Like we were like cast and had locations and we had the whole thing. So yeah, it was
And were there any names in the cast?
No, none. I mean, it was Celine played the lead and we had an actor named Jared Abramson who had done some Sundance movies. He's like an amazing actor. but was still kind of, you know, finding a name. And then we had a rapper named Fat Lip, who's from the Far Side, but like had never acted and no one knew who he was.
He was in
and
that Spike Jonze video. Jonze used to draw those videos.
He was in that Spike. That Spike Jonze video. But it was a very, you know, it was a very creative based cast. It was not built on like financing. I mean, that's what's funny is like, we were also, we didn't understand that that's what you needed. So we didn't do it the other way because we didn't know any better. We were just kind of like, it makes more sense creatively. And we were like, what? We could have gotten more money. Like, we didn't understand that that's how it worked. Now I do, but at the time.
In retrospect, do you think that anyone would have adjusted things in some way or started the plan out differently? Or because, you know, to me, it's like, well, look, if you got the movie made with the creative decisions you wanted to make, that sounds like a happy ending, you know?
I mean, they definitely, you know, we all had a hard one with that one because it came out during COVID. So it just didn't hit in the way we all wanted it to. And not because it's not a great movie, but because like, it just, we couldn't show it to anyone. Like we just couldn't, we premiered at Venice and like, it technically premiered at South By. They won the director's award. It premiered at Venice. It won the technical award. Like it had an incredible, it had every review you could imagine, like Hollywood Reporter, everyone gave it like the best reviews. And then we just couldn't get it seen because everyone was like, we're not buying movies right now. And like, we don't know what's going to happen with theaters and we don't know what's going to happen with indie film. And like, we had all of the big people and, you know, interested in buying it. There was like a real battle for a second. And then everyone just kind of dissolved because of the timing of COVID. So I don't know if we would have done anything different because we just kind of just got, we were like a casualty of COVID in a weird way.
Yeah. No one expects worldwide pandemic.
No.
Yeah. Crazy. I'm just curious for personal reasons. Like how do you cast an amazing 5-year-old actor? Like how do you start?
We got her cast very lucky. So Jennifer Venditti, who is a casting director who does like Euphoria and like, I think she did like American Honey. She's done movies like that. We reached out to her as basically like, would you cast our movie? And she hadn't said yes. She hadn't said anything. And then she responded with tapes of this little girl who ended up being our lead. And she was like, I'm at a casting for Euphoria in a church. And this little girl walked in with her dad because they thought it was a food bank. And I swear to God. And she was like, I think this is your little girl. She was like, I read your script last night. I can't do it. I'm busy. But like, this is your kid. And then she sent us
thought it was tapes. A food bank.
And she walked well, out, she a movie
whipped out an A-plus audition.
She didn't give an audition. She brought her across the street to a diner and the little girl, she just talked to her and the little girl just like ate crackers. I mean, Selena Logan, like the little girl never saw a script. She never did lines. Like they never said action or cut. Like there was never like
does
a
she
movie.
She knows she's in a movie.
She knows she's in a movie, but like she doesn't really know what it was about. Like, we never told her, we never, like the scenes are all just her interacting with people and people would just kind of feed her what we need her to say. And that's
She was seven
at the time. Yeah. I mean, but that's the way they work. Like Caroline, if you go back and watch Caroline with the three kids, like most of those shots, those three kids are never in the car at the same time ever. Like they're all stitches. Like the kids in the back, it's a stitch. It's two different shots that Logan, the director and editor, like put together and you're panning from kid to kid. And like, same thing with the little girl and Caroline, like she didn't know what the movie was about. Celine just told her, hey, I'm going to go in there and I need you to like, look for me. And I need you to like wonder when I'm coming back because it's going to get hot. And the little girl just like looked around for a while.
Wait, but then she never like looked into the lens or like asked like, am I doing this right? Or
I mean, her and the lead in the feature, both those kids spike the camera 1,000 times and Logan edits their eyes to never move.
Really?
That's funny.
Because that's the hardest thing about kids is they're always like, is this what you wanted me to do in the middle of the scene?
I mean, most of the scenes, she spikes it or she yawns 1,000 times. Logan edited her eyes, so her eyes are never moving.
I love that.
They're just constantly in one direction. But that's all VFX. Like, same thing with Caroline. It's all VFX. Everything.
Wait, so they're just like, say this, ask for this, look
they
for that.
They never even say this. They're just like, where are the keys? And they'll hide the keys. And little girl will be like, I don't know where the keys are. And she's like, where are the keys? And a little girl just keeps doing it. Like, that is the way they work is like, they naturally just ask questions. And
like
they
the ultimate, what's my motivation
right.
answer.
Oh, yeah. So let me ask though then, so is it on a technical level, is it something where they're maybe sometimes acting as like the scene partner, or like are things bouncing back and forth? Are they behind the camera? Are they kind of in the scene and then like, you know, painting themselves out later, or kind of all of the above?
Oh, they're all of the above. Like, well, there's two of them. So Celine acts in Caroline, and she acts in the feature as the mom. And they did that purposefully because she could have a relationship with the little girl and could feed her lines. Not feed, but like, sure, could get lines, yeah, out. And in Logan, she had an earpiece in her ear, and Logan would say like, I need her to say that again, or it was out of focus, or like, do that again, or can you do it? Like, and he would feed that to her kind of, and then Celine would kind of keep pulling it out. So it was, I mean, there are so many shots in our feature where like Logan has a wig and a little jacket on, and he's like holding a monitor, and it's like her corner, because we had to like lose her at child hours. And like the whole, I mean, Celine's never acting off of that kid. Like every shot with Celine is like someone in a wig probably.
And when you're shooting, is there a moment you're nervous about like whether
you're like, wait a minute,
whole thing is going to work?
Oh, like every day, all the day. Yeah. I mean, it also like doesn't work 90% of the time. Like there's so many times where Shayla would just like wouldn't be in the mood, like the little girl or Caroline. I mean, like there's a whole scene in Caroline where she's like kind of crying. And that came because like, I think I gave her a couple pickles and she had too many pickles. And I was like outside of the car and she was looking at me and she was like, can I have a pickle? And I was like, no more pickles, Caroline. And she just started crying and they were just rolling. And I think they just VFX'd her mouth to be quiet. And she's like looking around, but like under her breath, she's going like, all I want is a pickle. And like, Carol won't give it to me. Like she's just crying about that. But in the shot, she's crying about like her mom leaving.
That's so good. Well, so that's incredible. I think like all of those tricks are incredible. And I guess because you have the history with them of knowing what they're capable of and seeing the VFX work, and, you know, that gives you a sense of safety. But I guess, how do you convince financiers that this will work? You know, like there's,
I mean, for them, you don't. Like they already do. Like they, you know what I mean? Like they have so much work. It's harder for the people who don't have work. Like that's the sell you have to figure out. It's the people like them. You're just like, look at them. Like they have accomplished amazing things. They're very talented people. Like I remember going into the feature, we had such an incredible team of crew, because we were all kind of like, this will be a great movie. There will be no, it's not even a question if it'll be good, because like, look at all of their shorts. They're so amazing. So it's easy to convince people that. It's the people who like have kind of an average short or like haven't really done a short. And you're kind of trying to convince people then like, no, I believe in them. Like they're going to be great. But Celine and Logan are very easy. They're also the most prepared people you've ever met in your life. Like they storyboard every moment. So like every moment you need that kid to look a certain way, they mark it off a list of like, hey, we got her looking to the left. We got her looking concerned. We got her looking down. Like they
have storyboarded. Even though she's never read a script or anything.
No. But they know that they build the scene by the storyboard. So they know what frame they need. And then they just basically move them around into that frame.
I love that. I feel like that unlocks something for me, because I feel like it would be easy to witness things and feel like, oh, they're just kind of like improvising. It's loosey goosey. How do you know
no,
the
it's
movie's
no
going to be there? But it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like the most planned, most precise, like very detailed storyboarding and like planning. I mean, the spreadsheets they have, like, they go into very detailed preparation for those reasons, because they just want to make sure they have every moment they need. And then when you get on set, it is supposed to be like, they don't hold words tightly. They're very just like, say it in your own words, like to actors. They're like, say it however you would say it. They
but
don't.
But when you're selling the script, is the script good? Or is the
script
like...
Oh, the script's incredible. I mean, it was, you know, one of the finalists for the Nichols Awards. Like they're an amazing writer. They write
so
like
dialogue a dialogue is good. And then they don't care if the actors say that.
Well, they do care, but you can't tell people they're going to change it. That's one thing I have learned through the years, is like, in the beginning I was like, and on Caroline, we never even saw a script, and I saw people's faces being like, what? And then after a while I was like, just don't share that part. Just leave that part.
Because the worst version of that is people thinking like, oh, well, they just got lucky, right? When you know the backstory of how everything works and how you know, it's the exact opposite. But yeah, that's interesting. That's really wonderful.
And I know they just, Celine and Logan just did a TV show. Were you involved with that?
I wasn't, no. That was the first thing I haven't done with them in a while. But my husband shot it, so I felt like I was involved because I knew all the goss. And it was fun. I mean, in a weird way, it was like kind of cool. I was working on a movie at the same time. I was gone shooting, and we were kind of, you know, talking about how our experiences were and how different it was from that feature. And that was a couple years ago, the first feature. So like, they've grown, like they've changed. They've kind of, you know, they learned how to use like a huge budget versus just like the tiniest budget. So I think in a weird way, we all kind of like learn from each other's experience, but no, I had nothing to do with it. I'm excited to see it though. I didn't even read the script because I don't like scary things. So something.
Well, I'm curious though. So now it sounds like you've kind of entered, you know, a slightly different phase of your career where those initial people that you got to cherry pick along the way, right? Like you're all kind of maybe growing in different directions or something, right? Or obviously you still like to work with those people, but it sounds like maybe you're working with people outside that you didn't grow up with, didn't come up with. How do you come across those projects? How do you partner with them? And what's it like to work with people who, you know, you don't have the same sort of history with?
Yeah, I mean, Alex and Eleanor, I never did a short with, who I did Save Yourselves with, the directors. Like, we got coffee, and I remember I met Alex's manager at Sundance, one of those years that I was, like, looking for people. And she was like, what do you want to make? And I was like, I just want to make something, like, weird. Like, I want to make something that's, like, smart and funny and weird. And I remember she was like, do I have the script for you? And she sent me a different script by Alex. And I read it, and it was like a $10 million movie. And I was like, I don't even know how to begin. Like, I can't, I'm not there yet. And so I met with Alex, and I remember being like, I'm such a fan of your writing. And he was like, well, I have this tiny little movie my girlfriend and I wrote, but like, I don't know if you want to read it. And I read it, and it was Save Yourselves. And I was like, please let me do this movie. Like, I had never worked with them before. It was like very fresh. Alex had one short that was called Snowy Bing Bongs, and Eleanor had one short, and like, they both had their own shorts and their own careers, but like that was very much kind of a kismet moment of me just being like, this is what I want. I laughed out loud at your script. Can I please have a chance? And then they like took a chance on me. So that happens a few times. Like now, I'd say now I probably get submitted more like through friends. Like a lot of, now I'm in the film community, I feel like more. So a lot of friends will be like, oh, you should read my friend's script. It's really great. Or like agents and managers, I feel like now I have a relationship with them in a stronger way where they'll send me stuff. I mean, during the pandemic is weird. Like there was a moment in the pandemic where everything shifted and there are not enough producers who know how to make a movie. And there are a lot of creative producers, as we call them, who have never made a movie. And there was a moment where there were a lot of creative producers who had financing and had projects set up, but did not know how to do it. So there were a lot of people reaching out to people like me and my friends who kind of do this, who were like, hey, we just need someone to go make the movie. So I kind of got hit up by a lot of those, which was new. Like I'd never had that before. I kind of always built my own stuff. So that was a little weird. Interesting.
Did you end up doing any of those?
I did one. I mean, I wouldn't say it came together quite like that, but I did a movie called Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul. And I was not involved in the development. I was not involved in attaching the cast and nothing to do with the script. Like, it was by the Sundance, it's a Sundance director named Adama Igbo and her twin sister. And they're both like very cool Nigerian directors who were like working in TV as writers. And Daniel Kaluuya's company found them with a woman named Rowan Riley and Amandla. And they basically found them, found the script, put on Regina Hall and Sterling K. Brown, put this incredible cast, Daniel's producing. And then it just kind of ended up that all of them weren't really those type of producers. Like they didn't, you know, Rowan works for Daniel's company and Adama and Adana had never made a movie. And so they kind of called me to be like, hey, we need someone who can go do it. And that was definitely one where like I kind of stepped in last minute because honestly, like another movie of mine lost financing. So I was like available all of a sudden. And it was a cool script and it was a cool story. And yeah, so I got to do that one.
And so you shot that during COVID.
We shot that during COVID. I shot that. I shot a TV show and then I shot another feature during COVID. It was a little wild.
And was the TV show a studio show?
No, the TV show was a Snapchat show, which was the wildest thing I've ever done.
Was it vertical?
It wasn't vertical. It was through a company called Portalay. And during the pandemic, they offered me the Snapchat show and I was available. And I honestly, like the showrunner is a longtime friend of mine that I've known for a really long time. And he wrote it and I'm such a fan of his. And he brought it to me and I was free. And I was like, yeah, let's make a movie. So or let's make a TV show. We shot it like a movie, to be honest. But yeah, so I did that.
That's awesome. So now you're doing a movie with M. Night Shyamalan, and you're doing a movie alongside producer Joel Edgerton, Brian Cranos' movie, I Don't Understand You. So obviously one is Celine and Logan's movie. How did the other movie come about?
The other movie came about, so I've known Brian Crano and his boyfriend, or husband, sorry, David Craig. David and I were cater waiters together when I was 17. And he was with me when I was like a wedding planner. And then we both were assistants at the same time. And then we both like moved on from assisting and he started
producing. Those are deep roots. That's wild. Yeah.
It's deep roots. It's very deep roots. We were like in New York City struggling for 10 years together. And he started working for Joel as his assistant like 10 years ago and has basically moved up. And I was working assistant and we both kind of moved up in our world. And David is now Joel's producing partner and runs his company, Five Henrys. And Brian and David, I've like always wanted to work with them because I've known them for so long. And I've known Joel for a long time because of David. And they wrote this movie and they sent it to me. And to be honest, I'd like, they were kind of the ones I was scared to work with because they're my really good friends. And I was like, is it going to ruin a friendship? And then I read it and I was just so obsessed with it. And I was like, please let me try and take it out. So we just attached Nick Kroll and Andrew Rannell. And we are going to start taking it out this fall for people. So we'll see.
Cool. So when you have Joel Edgerton or M. Night Shyamalan, do you still have to figure out the financing too and casting, or does it make everything way easier?
It's different. So M. Night's paying for it. His company, Blinding Edge, is fully financing Selena Logan's movie. And that came from Selena and Logan and I had developed a script during COVID. And we were going to take it out to look for financing and attach. We already attached cast. We had attached Eliza Scanlon and Dylan O'Brien. And we were like getting ready to take it out. And then while they were filming Servant, M. Night was like, what are you working on?
Oh, which he is his show, right?
Servant. His show. Yeah. And so he was like, what else are you working on? Like, I love your work and I'm such a fan. And they just hit it off. And then he read the script and was like, this is the craziest thing I've ever read. Like, why don't we do it with you? So then we kind of partnered and did it. And I leave in a few weeks to go shoot it. So. And then Joel's movie, I am looking for financing. So anyone, you know, who's listening.
How much do you need?
I need probably 10 million.
I would be so
Yeah, okay. Yeah, 10 million, 10K is the same.
I'm curious about, because I feel like there have been murmurs and even like guests who've kind of like mentioned that it's an interesting and weird time to be looking for financing specifically right now, right? Like the glut of projects that were written over the pandemic and then everyone kind of waiting to try and shoot something, it's kind of created a bottleneck. What's your experience in terms of just looking at things right now, especially since you've got that knack for it and the love of it? You know, I think that's the thing that's interesting and unique about you.
Yeah, I mean, that is very true. The bottleneck is 100% true. I think I've been very lucky, to be honest. Like, it has nothing to do with skill, but like 100% luck that I've just been around productions that have been going. Like the financier of Honk for Jesus, I have now become very integrated with them and their company, which is called Pinky Promise, and they're a new financier and they are actively looking for stuff. So like, there is a level of which I'm like now helping them find stuff and like we're talking about projects to do together. So I've just been very lucky where the projects that I have been a part of that are bottleneck are already set up places. The places that I'm working with already really like me. And they're like, well, what else are you doing? So I'm able to like bring stuff back in. But people who haven't, I feel very, very sad and very, I wouldn't say scared, but like very sad for the people who haven't made their first feature at like now. Like I got really lucky. I feel like we all kind of snuck in right before COVID and had a few movies under our belt. So now we're whatever people think, like they think that we actually know what they're doing now. But the people who were doing that before and they just like just missed the window, it's like, it just feels like you're 100 feet behind everyone else. Like it's so frustrating to see friends and colleagues who are like absolutely more, you know, as talented, if not more, and have just as incredible projects, but like they just can't get the meeting because they're just too backed up. And like, I haven't had that experience, but I see it happening very, very much. So
because of COVID, you're saying?
Yeah, because of COVID and because everyone's waiting to see what happens. Like, you know, last year at Sundance, nothing sold. Like Coda sold, which is always the thing everyone reads. Like you're like, well, one movie sold. And you're like, one movie out of 4,000 movies sold. Like that's not good odds. Like, and everyone only uses the one as their right. thing. And you're
Blair Witch Project made $1 billion. So
but the thing is, the year that Blair Witch Project sold, a bunch of other movies sold also, right? Like that's Kara's point.
Exactly. Like there's nothing being sold now except for like one or two or three. Like there's so few. And now everyone's kind of waiting to see like if festivals are even going to be a thing anymore. Like they're fun and we have a great time and we all have our communities there, but like, are people actually buying movies there? Are people actually selling movies there? Like, how does it work? And I think that people are waiting for the pandemic to come a little bit further and for them to see like our theaters opening again. can you put a movie on a streamer with no stars and have success?
Like, what
can
does
you
the
get
model
buzz around
like
something that has no
future,
one?
Basically,
yeah. Like, there is no model right now. Like, right now, the weird model is like, can you make a $1 million movie with Chris Pine? And like, the answer is no. So like, there, I don't know where to go. No, but I mean, like, indies right now have these huge expectations where like, you can't get financing unless you have like Scarlett Johansson, and you're like, you're not going to get her. So like, that $1 million movie isn't going to happen if that's what you need.
Yeah. Scarlett Johansson is bummed that she thinks she made $50 million less than she was supposed to.
I know. Like, movie, so. That's what's crazy.
Might be
like
expensive.
All the indie people I know who used to just be more about like, well, this person's has a really good episode of TV and they're kind of like popping. It's like, now everyone's just going to the biggest stars because it's the only way you can even be seen right now. And it's just like a waste. And it's like, it's a waste because you're just spinning your wheels because they're never going to do those movies.
Yeah. Well, Matt, there goes your feature.
Well,
I do think there's hope. Like, I think it will bounce back. I just think right now it's a waiting game.
No doubt. And I think, like, to your point, I think once things, the dust just hasn't settled yet, right? And it feels like it has, because things are opening up and people are vaccinated, and we're going to pretend that we're not worried about the Delta variant for a second. But that's still going to, the film world takes, you know, a couple years to you know, figure itself out, basically, in this case. You know, we're still feeling that wave.
I mean, even getting into Sundance, it's like, I know everyone in the world right now who's like, we're shooting for Sundance, you know, we've been holding on to a year. And I'm just like, what is it even gonna look like? Like, they just announced yesterday that you have to be vaccinated to go, which I think is very smart, but also what will it look like? Like, will people
I heard all
go?
The top buyers are unvaccinated, so
yeah. Exactly. Only people, you know,
what do they know?
The
we
lowest
don't know.
Places are vaccinated.
Yeah. And what about TV? Is that not the answer to all of our problems?
I know. Well, TV's the other thing, right? It's like so oversaturated. There's too many shows. There's too many things. There's too many people. Like, everyone has a TV show that's maybe going to be set up somewhere right now. And you're kind of like, well, everyone can't have a TV show. Like, how are they all going at the same time?
Yeah. Well, and I think the difference also between TV and indie film, it's obvious, but like, being able to get something going, to self-finance something, or to like put your own development funds in to like shoot that proof of concept and get it up and running, you know, it's a heck of a lot, I don't want to say easier, but it's a different, we're still thinking about it from the old world, but like, there was a model for independent film in a way that hasn't really been a model for independent television, even if you could figure out how to get it made.
No, I don't know the model of, I mean, the only way I think an independent television, I'm on a TV show right now that is considered an independent TV show. It's with a studio, but it's not like set up anywhere, but it's the most experimental, like art house, like wild kind of thing. So it's like, I don't even know if it'll be a TV show. Like, it might turn into something else very quickly, but for now we're all calling it TV. So I don't know. I don't know if the model exists in the same way.
Where are you shooting your movie that's coming up?
The M. Night Shyamalanian one. It is in Shreveport, Louisiana, everyone's favorite city in the United States.
They have the highest Delta rate.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to the center because we want to cure it. So we're going to, you know.
that's a smart idea. Is shooting places for tax incentives still a thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why we're going to Shreveport. That's the whole thing. You get a nice big tax credit. I mean, the tax credit's huge. Like, we got denied. I have a movie that we tried to shoot in Oklahoma, and they told us they weren't sure if they would let us because it was like too, it looked bad on Oklahomians. Is that what you call them? Oklahomans? I don't know. But it looked bad on them. So they did not want us to shoot there. And we were confused, and we were like, but do you have a choice? Like, can you tell us no? Can't we just shoot there anyway? And they were like, well, we can just like not welcome you. And I was like, what does that mean though?
You're like, I'm from New York.
Creatively, it was... It painted Oklahomans in a negative light?
Yeah, which is funny because it's based on like a Oklahoma law. Like, the movie is about a 15-year-old girl who has an affair with a 30-year-old youth pastor. And they were just like, it makes them, you know, it makes it look like youth pastors do that to young women. But we're like, no, but it's based on the idea that like in Oklahoma, you can get married at 15. Like, that's the point of the movie. Like, she has all the agency. Like, it's not like a weird, it's not like a misconduct in the movie. It's like, it's about the idea of like, what age do you have your own you know, desires and sexual whatever. But like, yeah, they basically were just like, well, we just don't want to promote that. And we were like, yeah, but it's a thing that happens.
Yeah,
so.
You know what they say in Oklahoma, everything's okay.
Everything's good.
Yeah, I guess I never thought about that. I know in Israel, there's like a fund for making content there that makes the country look good.
Oh, totally.
Like they will give you, you know, more money, like money to come shoot stuff there that yeah. paints it in a positive light. So,
oh, 100%.
I get that. I haven't heard that too much in the U.S., but I guess
Shreveport
that makes
doesn't
sense.
Have that. I don't think they're concerned about making it look good, but it's fine.
Right. They're like, we had True Blood here. Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
Everyone dies.
It is funny. Like the place we're shooting, we went to, and we were like, we're doing a movie. Like we scouted, and the people, I'm actually from like 45 minutes from where we're shooting. So everyone knows everyone in my family probably. And I, when I was there, I was like, oh, we're bringing a movie. And they were like, we did a Disney movie 25 years ago. And it was like incredible. And I was like, that's sure. the only story they have. Like no one's ever.
There's photos it, so. Still up in the like diner.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. He's like wearing the shirt still. So I'm excited to go. Cause it feels in a great way, it feels like fresh and new. Like maybe we won't, you know, bump into, like I just shot in Atlanta and it's like everyone is so used to it. You can't do anything. So I'm excited to be able to go into places and be like, don't you want to be in a movie and your location right. too?
And you and 1,000 friends can come.
Yeah, come hang out. You just redo the same motion 4,000 times and we won't
hang out with your friends, but don't say anything.
don't really talk.
Don't look at the thing on the crane.
If they do, Logan will just edit their eyes out. So it's fine.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, congrats on all these things. I mean,
thanks.
Sounds like you've had an incredibly successful pandemic.
I mean, let's hope. I don't know. They could all be garbage, you know? Who knows?
Well, they're probably not. I mean, if they premiered at Venice and all those things and they have M. Night attached, I mean. Yeah. So at least a 50% chance.
Yeah, exactly.
I gotta go dig up. I have a photo of me at like a test screening with M. Night when I'm like
no way.
18 at like the sign. I think it was a Signs test screening, and I had a disposable camera that I took with me to all of like test screenings, hoping that I would see directors that I liked there. And I've got
chin
strap beard, you know, it was like I'm a freshman in college and I'm just like so excited. And I think I'm wearing an Edward Scissorhands t-shirt.
I love that. My parents are stoked. I mean, they're like, they call him Midnight because I mean, they like actually know who he is, but they just call him Midnight. And my dad will constantly be like, does Midnight want to come over for a barbecue? Like we could show him our new griddle. And I'm just like, so it's like very fun to see him coming.
Yeah. Well,
so
that
we'll
is a cool nickname.
You know, I'll start calling him that now.
So what if people want to find out more about what you're working on? What's the best way to do that? IMDb Pro, Kara DeRay on Instagram.
I really don't do the IMDb thing. I should keep up with it more. People get mad at me. They're like, my movie's not up there. And I'm just like, well, I don't know, whatever. Like,
you're like, if it doesn't get into Sundance, I'm not putting it on IMDb.
I'm not putting trash on you know, I only take Sundance or Venice.
You know that our podcast is on IMDb.
So get ready.
Is it?
But I'm very bad at updating it. Yeah.
I need the credits. I don't know. I guess Instagram. Yeah, Instagram. I think I'm fun to work with. Hopefully people find me. I'm
Be
a great
careful
time,
what you
know?
Wish for, Kara, because, you know.
I know.
Yeah. How many scripts do you want? Just if it's set in Shreveport, Louisiana, Kara will read it. So send it to her.
Actually, the opposite. If it's set in Italy, I will read it. Or somewhere else exotic and beautiful. If it's in Shreveport, I am immediately passing. Please do not send me those scripts.
Do you like, I know we're wrapping up, but I'm just curious. Do you like shooting in LA? Is that a thing that you're into or not into?
I've only ever shot the Snapchat show in LA. That's it.
And you live in LA, right?
I live in LA. I've shot commercials here and like music videos and small stuff, but I've never shot a feature here. I've shot a few in New York. I've shot in Atlanta. I've shot in Texas. I've shot in other places, but I've never done it here. I mean, I wish I could shoot here. I like LA. I would love to shoot
here.
It's
nice to sleep in your own bed, you know?
I know. I mean, the one time I shot in LA, we shot in Pomona, which is not LA. So it was not a good time.
Hey, take it easy. Pomona's not bad. Well, we've got a racetrack. We've got a college.
It was a rough time. I know all the people listening from Pomona, they're like, hey, wait a minute. We're not Shreveport. Yeah, I would really love to shoot in LA. Lola and I both talked about that. Like, neither of us shoot in LA, and it would be so nice. It'd be great.
Yeah, that's my new thing. I mean, I have a newborn and a 5-year-old, so it's like when I go out of town, it's draining, you know, on my family. So
yeah,
it's a new thing.
I know we kind of travel as a unit. Like we have two pugs. We're those people.
And you bring them?
I bring my pugs and they go to the production office and I'm like the pug lady.
Do they
like, it's like what I always imagine.
A crate on the airplane?
No, they go under the seat.
But do they have in those bags, right?
Yeah. They have the bags. We like separate them and then they go. But it's funny, like it is weird rolling up a set and you're like, I'm the producer. And then like your pugs are following behind you.
Well, it's better than you being the PA and having your pugs. That's also you.
It's very true. I'm only a producer so I can put my pugs.
I always joke. I feel like I'll have made it when it's someone else's problem to watch a dog for me. Like you bring the dog to set and then you pawn it off on some schmuck. That's great.
It's so true. I was totally paying our interns, like Venmoing them to be like, can you take the dog out today? Like, I'm going to leave it at the office.
Kara,
it
sounds like you've made it.
At least I paid them.
There you go.
I know.
There you go.
Yeah, it's the not just height one of my pug. Career. It's how many pugs you have that really is how you measure success.
When I get three, you know I'm some pretty big movies.
Yeah, so. That's when Bill Macy will come ask to be your
pug. I like the idea of the sound guy just being mad. Like your pugs are like, they've got bells on their little collars and they're breathing heavy.
Like, could you get a breed with a little less drool?
I brought them once. I brought one of them to a Planned Parenthood shoot I did. It was like a PSA. Like supporting Planned Parenthood. And we were it was in LA and we were in this tiny studio and I didn't know. And she came with me and we were sitting in the corner and this woman is telling like the most beautiful story about like, you know, her abortion or something. It was like making her own choice and everyone in the room's crying. And then all of a sudden the sound guy was just like, yeah, he was like, I hear something. And it was like, in the corner. And I was like, well, I'm so sorry. It's my pug. And like had to put her away. It was so bad.
Come on.
They are cute, those pugs.
I know. It was not good, you guys. Not good.
Awesome. Well, are you down to hang out with us for just a few more minutes to give an unpaid endorsement?
Of course.
Unpaid endorsements.
So I have a history with unpaid endorsements of just endorsing the dumbest, trashiest reality television ever. Like I,
The floor is lava is not.
I was going to say reality TV. So now I don't feel like I can. Mine was going to be reality.
Is it Love Island?
No, I can.
Oh, no, but I've been watching it the last few weeks. I love Love Island.
Love Island.
So.
Oh,
it's on Netflix? CBS, bro.
It's on Hulu, too.
You don't have cable, do you, man?
I pay for Paramount Plus and Hulu Live so that I can get love. So here's what happened. I was at my sister-in-law's birthday party, and her friend was telling us a story about how she'd been flirting with this guy at the farmer's market, and all of a sudden he wasn't there anymore. And she was like, oh, where'd this cute guy go? And she asks her the other guys who work at the meat stand where she buys her fancy meats. Turns out that dude was Christian on Love Island. And so we were like, oh, this is such a funny story. We've got to figure out who this dude is. Like, maybe we should watch a little bit of the show, and immediately got hooked. This show is on 5 nights a week. If you pay for Paramount Plus, you get bonus episodes. So you can basically watch it every night. And it is.
We share that login. we'll talk after.
I got you. It is, as a fan of The Circle, this is a new chapter in my life. I don't really.
Oh, it's way better than The Circle. It's so much better.
What I think is, so for people who don't know, the premise basically is just hot people in bathing suits hanging out, but basically they decide who they're going to hook up with or couple with, basically. And like the odd man out gets dumped at the end of the week. And then towards later on in the season, you get to vote people off, basically. The viewing audience gets to log on to the app and say who their least favorite are. And they keep adding new sexy people. And so everyone's like, oh, maybe this person's the person I have a crush on now. So it's very, very, very dumb. But it's nice to have just like some ambient gossip. You know, it's like, oh, the gossip is a thing that we don't have as much of anymore because of the pandemic. And so I didn't ever think that I would ever miss that or even had much of that in my life. But I realized it is sort of like having really trashy friends to hang out with every once in a while. And that's kind of fun right now. So that's my weird endorsement.
I know mine.
All right. Well, Kara, take it away.
I have never heard of this movie. Everyone has heard of it. Everyone I tell has been like, yeah, you idiot. Like it was really big. Yeah, it was great. Have you seen Avatar? No, it was, have you ever seen the movie The Impossible?
Oh, yeah. About the hurricane? I actually saw it in Thailand. It was crazy.
What?
Yeah. I have not heard of this movie. This is a perfect.
Yes, you have.
No, I haven't.
Amazing.
I don't know.
Matt, thank you.
It's so good. I mean,
never heard of it. Never saw it, never heard of it. Selena and Logan, I was at their house and they pulled it up to show me a scene that's like similar to the movie we're doing. And they're like, we want to do this. And I was like, wait, what is this movie? And it's like 11:30 at night. I was in New York at their house like last week. I was like, what is this movie? And they were like, oh, you've never seen The Impossible? I never even heard of it. And I watched the entire thing from beginning to end until 2 a.m. weeping. It is the most incredible like movie, but not only incredible movie, it's like the actual physical making of it is unbelievable. Like we looked up all the stages after. I was so kind of amazed by how they did it. It's amazing. I know everyone's gonna be like,
all
that
the
movie
stages
happened
10 years of where they filmed, you mean?
Yeah, like the way they built the hurricane and the way that this, like the water stage, the way they kind of built the props and then flowing through it. And like, it's fascinating to look it up. But I was obsessed with this movie for like a few days, and everyone I've told has been like, yeah, you think you should have gotten on board 10 years ago when it came out. Like, I didn't know about it, but it was incredible. It was such a good movie. So that's
awesome.
Mine.
Oh, yeah. That's really good.
Love it.
I mean, the visual effects or however they pulled that stuff off is
next level.
Yeah. Well, I was going to talk about a Twitter thread, as I often do, because I waste a lot of my time there. And it's from Franklin Leonard, you know, the creator of The Blacklist and an avid tweeter. He tweeted out this thread of movies that have like rock bottom Rotten Tomato scores and really high audience scores.
I thought you were going to talk about, he got in a Twitter war with Ben Stiller about nepotism this week as well. That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Oh yeah. He's interesting. Him and this guy, John Zauzierny, who I've recommended before. He's a manager that talks about, you know, why people will, he gives a lot of advice to writers about like how to get their projects off the ground and stuff and why people will rep them. But they just talk a lot about like Adam Sandler movies that have like 11% on Rotten Tomatoes and like, you know, 75% audience scores and just the mismatch sometimes between the tomato meter and what audiences think. And I just thought it was really interesting. Like even like Uncut Gems, which is a movie that I really, really, really liked. It has like a 91% tomato meter score, but like a 50% audience score. And it just reminds you, I guess, two things. One is that like the more you know about film, like the more your taste kind of shifts to be different than like mainstream audience. And also, if critics don't like your film, it has literally nothing to do with like what your mom will think of your movie, you know, like or how people will take your movie. So it's kind of, I think you can find silver linings in many ways from this tweet. He basically talks about, he finds movies that had at least 20,000 audience ratings. Like Man on Fire has an 89% audience score and a 38% tomato meter. Bad Boys 2 is like 78% rotten, or audience score, 23% tomato meter. Super Troopers, National Lampoon's Van Wilder, you know, like 18 and 73. It's just kind of, I don't know, it's fun to see how off the critics can be from the audience.
Totally. How drastically different. As my mom and dad always say, like, can you just make a happy movie? I haven't yet. One day I'll make them proud and they'll have a movie that they enjoy.
Well,
yeah. Like they have Bright on here. Bright, you know, I think in the industry was kind of known to be a pretty bad movie. And it has an 83% audience score, and they're making, Netflix is making a second one. So when everyone's like, why didn't they make a sequel to that? It's because people like it.
Oh my God, I love that. Killing of a Sacred Deer is like, I think it's such a, no, not Killing of a Sacred Deer, Lobster. If you've ever seen it. One of my favorite movies, Love the Lobster. And I made my family watch The Lobster one Thanksgiving. And my dad was just like, I don't understand you. Like he was so disappointed and so confused that I would even suggest such a thing. So
I get it. It's an interesting, weird movie, but I don't get the,
you like, and my dad, man.
Like why people were like, this is the, like people, so many people were like, you got to see this movie. I thought is, I like,
they're like
next
how
movie.
I am about The Impossible now.
The Impossible is, I challenge someone to watch that movie and not appreciate it. It's
the extras alone, like the people in the hospital. I mean, it's just next level. We can have a whole podcast about The Impossible.
Well,
I just want to meet those
people. We have friends who have a Mission Impossible podcast and they're,
yes,
well over 100 episodes.
I would love to go on that podcast and only talk about The Impossible Naomi Watts movie.
And my wife can talk about Impossible Burgers for 20 minutes.
The Carrots can really tag team that one.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Kara, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Of course. You guys
it was
are
really
so lovely.
Fun talking to you. We're super excited to see what you're doing next, and maybe one day
thanks.
We'll be lucky enough to hire you or your husband.
Or would love that.
For something.
Anytime.
I mean, or
please hire us.
Yeah, kind of the other way around. Awesome. Well, if you have questions about anything we talked about on the show, or you want to write us just to say how much you liked this one or anything else, you can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com or tweet at us or on all social media at justshootitpod. And I'm at Mr. Matt Emo.
And I'm at O'Kaplan on Instagram. I'm at Smitey Pileg on Twitter, which I don't really tweet that much, but I do realize like I like a lot of tweets. So if you follow me, you'll see the things I like, and then maybe you'll discover some new things.
All of my tweets, basically.
I sometimes I see Matt's tweets. I'm like, not that funny, but I should like this so Matt feels better about himself. And then,
if you want to see a lot of pug content, you can follow my Instagram. That's all that's there.
I'm just kidding. Matt's tweets are very funny. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our social media manager is Derek Aiello. So I think we might be losing him soon. I'm really sad about.
Such a bummer, but Derek. Great work, Derek. We'll probably say goodbye a few more times.
Yes, and the music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive, and the artist is Czar. And we will catch you next time. Thanks everyone.
Everyone.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.